Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, August 3rd, 2020, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And this week, I want to thank the top patrons from last month. They include Mary Neva, Michael Gaucher, Brian Holden, Charles Payet, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, Ulrika Hagman, Pasquale Gelati, Daniel Lang, Christopher Pitts, and June Sapara. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. If you want to hear your name at the top, or you just want to learn more about how you can support Talk Nerdy, visit patreon.com/talknerdy. There you can pledge your support. You can also go to talknerdymerch.com and pick up some cool swag. All right, guys, this is going to be a really exciting episode. I had the opportunity to sit down with a professor of anthropology and the director of the Historic Preservation Program at the University of Nevada, Reno. Her name is Dr. Carolyn White. And her most recent book, guys, this is really fascinating, is called The Archaeology of Burning Man, The Rise and Fall of Black Rock City. So yeah, we're going to talk about the archaeology of Burning Man. Without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Carolyn White. Well, Carolyn, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So your book has to be one of the most interesting kind of conceptual books, the most interesting research projects that I've seen come across my desk for sure. And I'm sure you get this all the time, but I have been doing this show now for like 7 years and I've interviewed a ton of different scientists and kind of academic experts in their fields. And never have we talked about Burning Man.
Oh, well, I'm happy to hear that it's something a little out of the ordinary.
Absolutely. So I myself am not a burner. I've never been to Burning Man, but I live in Los Angeles. And so I have a ton of friends that go to Burning Man every year, and they come from a lot of different walks of life. I hear a lot of different kinds of stories about the experience. But my assumption is that not everybody listening to the show knows what Burning Man is. So maybe we could start with just a brief overview of like, what is Burning Man on the whole?
Sure. Well, Burning Man is, of course, it's so many different things, but essentially it is an event that happens every year, with the exception of this year, up in the, on the Black Rock Desert Playa. And it's a city of, it's a temporary city that's built each year, and about 70,000 people go to this city to experience various things. People go to Burning Man for different reasons, but when they get there, what they find is a city that's laid out for them to find a place to camp in it. And it is a place that is very organized in some ways and very chaotic in others. But it is a place that's kind of free of dogma. So people go to have the experience that they want to have. But there are certain themes about the Burning Man itself, like a placement of art. Of course, a giant man is burned, and that's the culmination of the festival of the event.
And not a real man, by the way.
No, a wooden man. Yes, a giant 40-foot wooden man is burned. Yes. So it's kind of a hard thing to describe to people that don't know anything about it, because in many ways it seems like a festival like any other, but it's not really celebrating anything. It's kind of an event that people return to year after year, but it has its own particular form and kind of its own ethos and its own aesthetic.
Right. And so you are an archaeologist and you've been going to Burning Man, or at least been studying Burning Man, for like a decade at this point. What made you think that, I don't know, it's interesting because a lot of times when we think about archaeology, we think of like ancient sites. Mm-hmm. And so where did your interest sort of arise in looking at an active, ever-changing site? And then specifically, why pick Burning Man?
Yeah, well, I'm always very interested in how people live. I am trained as a traditional archaeologist, you know, one that excavates archaeological sites in squares. But the kind of archaeology that I've always done has been of the fairly recent past. So from kind of 18th century up to the 1950s. And within those archaeological sites, I've always been curious about daily life and the ways that people live on a regular basis, those sort of mundane tasks that people do and what the material form of those worlds looked like. And when I moved out west to Nevada, I started thinking about how to use some of these same ideas about looking at the everyday life of the past further up towards the present. And when I visited Black Rock City in 2006, I thought that Burning Man would be an opportunity to look at those things that I had been studying in the past and see it in the present. At first, I thought it was useful just because Burning Man is a giant temporary city. But as I started to do the research more and more, I realized that this kind of active site archaeology could be applied to many different places. But Burning Man has a lot of things that are that really make it ripe for this kind of research. So it was a happy marriage of opportunity and an amazing place to study.
Right. And is there something intrinsically interesting about the concept of Burning Man? So obviously you're studying the site as an archaeologist, but the site is of Black Rock City is representative of the activities that happen there, the ethos of the individuals, you know, the sort of trek that they're making there each year to have some sort of, for many of them, what they would consider an existential or a transcendental, like a really intense experience. So was there something that about the actual Burning Man concept that drew you to it?
I would love to say that that was part of what pulled me to it. But in many ways, I think that was something that I was less interested in mm-hmm. about Burning Man to begin with. I mean, I had heard about Burning Man from my brother-in-law who had attended for a number of years back when I lived on the East Coast. And it, and I say this in the book, it was something that did not appeal to me whatsoever. But then when I started to become familiar with that landscape, I was actually working on a Depression era mining site that is right nearby. And a colleague that I worked with from the Bureau of Land Management mentioned when things started to get really dusty on our project that it was probably dust that was being kicked up by the people setting up for Burning Man. And then I realized, oh my gosh, I'm so close to this place. I should check it out. And when I visited Burning Man and Black Rock City for the first time with Dave Valentine, that Bureau of Land Management archaeologist, I was really mm-hmm. surprised at the gap between what I expected to see and what I did see. And all of those sort of fanciful stories about people's getting away from it all or having, like you say, these transformative personal experiences, that was present. But what was also particularly striking to me was within this, you know, do what you want, radical self-reliance, you know, seeing what you can get away with in the desert, that was juxtaposed to this extraordinary structure that was immediately visible in terms of the way the city was laid out and the way that this kind of undercurrent of organization ran through every component of the city. And
Interesting. So
that's what pulled me to it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost this kind of, I don't know, from what I've gathered, just talking to individuals who I know who have gone and who it's really spoken to, it's almost this like strangely anti-capitalist or post-capitalist place where people can go and there's a barter system and money doesn't mean anything and you build your own campsite and, you know, you participate. And it almost seems, like you said, a bit anarchistic or a bit like it's supposed to lack any sort of rules or structure, but ultimately mm-hmm. the only reason it works is because it's actually pretty highly organized, right?
Exactly. And it's an organization that is it's kind of antithetical to authority. I mean, it embraces its anti-authoritarian quality. But at the same time, you've got buy-in from 70,000 people to follow not rules, but principles. And those 10 principles have been very successful, I think, in kind of guiding the way the city works. One, which you mentioned, is this idea of radical self-reliance, that you have to come to Burning Man with everything that you need and everything that you're going to anticipate needing and giving away. And that makes a huge difference in how people kind of conduct themselves in the city. They're not expecting someone to take care of them.
Right. And so, I mean, that really brings me to what I first thought of when I thought about you doing archaeological work in a site where at one point in time, there's 70,000 people making it their home. And then, you know, within the blink of an eye, it's an empty playa in the middle of the desert. The idea here is very similar to the idea that you see in our National Park Service, which is, you know, take only photos and leave only footprints, like garbage in, garbage out. Do not leave your stuff behind. Keep this place clean. Do you find that, generally speaking, that is how people operate?
Yes, for the most part. Yeah, Burning Man is one of the 10 principles is leave no trace. And for an archaeologist, that is our worst nightmare, because we rely on people leaving traces, leaving things behind. We study their trash. But at Burning Man, that has some very interesting ramifications. For the most part, the leave no trace ethos is embraced by people. They call trash at Burning Man moop, matter out of place. And that's an anthropological term coined by Mary Douglas. And basically, if you are someone who leaves a lot of trash behind, you are a mooper, and that is a big insult. And there is a big cleanup at the very end of Burning Man, where the entire city is scoured by a follow-up cleanup crew, and they create a big moop map where they rank every inch of the city, green, yellow, or red. And if your site was clean, you get green. If it was somewhere between, you get a yellow. And if it was very dirty when you left that area, you get red. And since there are known inhabitants in a lot of the city because of the placement of theme camps, if your theme camp gets a red, then you're in big trouble and you probably won't be allowed to get placed and get an early spot the following year. So it's something that people take very seriously. Usually each camp has dedicated time for people to gather any trash that they may have dropped or may have blown into their area. So it is something that people do really value as critical to allowing the event to keep going. That being said, there are still things that are left behind, of course, and that those things are collected by the playa restoration crew during the month after Burning Man is over, during that big cleanup.
And are those the things that then translate for you as an archaeologist to artifacts?
Well, yes and no. One of the things that I've done, I've participated in the cleanup with the playa restoration crew. I've talked to those folks a lot. They do an incredible job. And at the very end, after that crew has done their work, the Bureau of Land Management does a big inspection, and they place a bunch of random points all around the city and collect anything within, you know, a 10-foot radius around those particular points. And Burning Man has to meet a certain standard, no more than 1 square foot of trash for each acre, basically. And those objects are collected. And Burning Man has passed that exam with flying colors every year. But one thing that does happen to those artifacts at the end is that they send them to me for analysis. And so I have all of those materials in my lab. It is not very much stuff at all. It fits in a small postal box each year. But one of the things that the kind of work that I've done at Burning Man through this active site archaeology is realize what the gap is between what is collected and what I can observe when I'm there at the site. So my work takes place mostly while people are living there and looking at the places where people live and how they build their structures, talking to them a little bit about some of the decisions they make about their camps, but observing those spaces through an archaeological lens of mapping and photography. And what is left behind is representative of a lot of the things that I see. But it also, to me, reveals some of the shortcomings of archaeology in fully understanding the past, because although archaeological methods are the best tools that we have to understand the past, they are also, they fall short. So I think that it is incumbent upon us as archaeologists to really try to think creatively about how we understand those things that are left behind and really think about the space between what we find and what could have been there and think a little bit more widely. And that's one of the things that studying Black Rock City has really made me think about, is the space between those things.
Right, because these artifacts themselves are just simply a fraction of what was. It's a similar issue in paleontology, where only a percentage of a percentage of things will ever actually be preserved. And so then millions of years later, utilizing that as sort of an index of everything that ever was, it's wildly, I don't want to say biased, but it's obviously not representative of the global whole.
Exactly. And it can't be. But I think sometimes people have this idea that archaeology is directly uncovering the ways that people lived. And that is a misunderstanding, I think, by the general public, but also a lot of archaeologists get very focused on the things that are left behind and forget to think about the gaps, those big gaps about what is not preserved or how things are changed over the course of time. And also that we have this myth or kind of misconception of the past through the so-called Pompeii promise, that these are worlds that are frozen in time and we're just simply uncovering them. But all the sites, for the most part, unless you're working at a place like Pompeii, which there are just not that many of those.
There's Pompeii.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, you can throw in Herculaneum with that, I guess. But all of the sites that we look at are abandoned, and people left those places for specific reasons. So we're really seeing the aftermath of the way people lived rather than the ways that they were in action.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like it seems like a really important tool to be able to actively observe and then maybe cross-reference your observations with some of the sort of post hoc analyses, like the artifacts that you find after the fact. Is it a type of approach to archaeology that is well received by your colleagues? Is it a field that you see more people kind of finding interest in?
Yes. I think yes and no. There's this kind of work draws on different ideas that have been around in archaeology for a long time. One of them is called ethnoarchaeology or experimental archaeology, where people do modern experiments to kind of think about the kinds of materials that are found in the past. For example, making stone tools and using them to in practice and see how the projectile points might break on impact or things like that, or making pottery to understand the modes of production. And that's been happening for a very long time in archaeology, to really to give us tools to understand the material world that we're finding. At the same time, using archaeology in the present on a site that people are actively living in has long been thought to be the realm of cultural anthropology rather than archaeology. And I think that the kind of archaeology that I do certainly draws on cultural anthropology as well, and that's an important influence. But to me, it's the same thing that I do when I'm looking at a site from, you know, 1950 or 1850, thinking about a site that people are using on a daily basis. And so that work falls in the realm of contemporary archaeology, which has gotten a bit of traction in the last 10 years or so, but that is a very new field.
Right. You know, something that strikes me, and oftentimes I'm drawing parallels with my own work and my own interests and my specialty now, it was neuroscience, but now it's clinical psychology. And one of the things we often talk about when we're talking about psychotherapy is sort of the difference between content and process. So the difference between like what is said, like the content of a conversation, and the process, like what are some of the processes that underlie that content. And it makes me wonder, you know, based on the conversation that we've had so far, how much of your work really is the content, like the artifacts, the findings, the reportable, you know, data, and how much of it really is this process, this kind of new approach or maybe hybrid approach that is helping you fill in some of those spaces in between the data?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting comparison, because I think that archaeology always has to kind of live in both of those worlds. Mm-hmm. All of the articles, all of the reports, all of the summaries of the work that we do has to have a methods section to describe what we've done and how we have done it. And a lot of archaeological work is methods-based. I mean, you can be trained as a specialist in geographic information systems, for example, that has an archaeological application, or being a faunal analyst, which has to do more with that particular technique than with a set of ideas that you're looking to understand. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, all of those modes are producing information, and they produce different kinds of information depending on what you're asking of your data. So I think that with contemporary archaeology and a project like this, I think that the development of this field of active site archaeology is, to me, supersedes the content of Burning Man itself.
Right.
At the same time, the particularities of Burning Man make it such a great place to kind of apply this perspective for the first time at a overarching site, that it's just kind of a perfect mesh of both of those elements.
And so, speaking of those particularities, I mean, I think something that really strikes me, even when you first look at your book, the actual publication, is this breathtaking photo on the cover of sort of like an aerial drone or maybe helicopter view of Black Rock City in action. And it looks like a sort of Mayan or Aztec civilization. It has this like spoke-like organization to it. There are these makeshift roads. It's so pulled back that the individual encampments are little dots, and they're organized in these concentric circles. I didn't realize that. I kind of expected Burning Man to just be like this, I don't know, pile of people.
Yeah, but this like is a big
bananas. Yeah, exactly. But this is so clean looking.
Yes, it's true. And those aerial shots are amazing. There is an airport at Burning Man, so that there are a number of aerial shots that happen each year by people going up in the planes, as well as some interesting drone stuff and Google Earth images. But yeah, the city itself has been this organized since 1998 was the first year that the city was designed. And some of that comes out of a problem that happened at Burning Man that you're imagining, of the kind of big mess on the playa of people every which way.
Right.
Back in 1996 was this a big shift when they had to start instituting some rules when the city reached about 8,000 people. So a fellow named Rod Garrett designed the city and developed it as this concept of a clock, with the city reaching from 2 o'clock to 11 o'clock, you know, through 6 o'clock, and designing those roads, the roads as spokes or the hands of the clock, and then these concentric roads. And amazingly, that form has been able to accommodate the growth of the city through these years with not all that much change. But the city itself is the very first thing that happens when the Burning Man organization kind of starts to think about moving on to the playa. They create the center point. They figure out where the boundaries will be. They start laying out the roads. And all of that is very clearly laid out. And then the city itself is filled in on the inside.
And so is there, you know, I don't know, a pecking order? How do you know where you get to slot in and set up your individual camp?
Yeah, there is a kind of zoning. If you are a member of a big theme camp or village, you can apply to get placed. That's what it's called, getting placed. And you have to fill out a request that includes what you'll be giving back to the community, how many people you'll be, what the theme is, etc. And if you get placed, then you will be told by the Burning Man organization where in the city your camp will be. So, for example, I have camped with the Alternative Energy Zone Village for many years. Shout out to them. They are a wonderfully organized city that has a theme of, well, you guessed it, alternative energy, which essentially means that there's no generators are allowed in the village. And so each year, several months before Burning Man starts, we will be told where the placement is. And then the mayor of the city starts to figure out within that big block, city block is how big that camp, the village is, where the individual camps will be. So there's kind of this secondary organization of that. But then that happens for many, many theme camps. And there's a kind of zoning with quieter camps in the center of the city around, you know, kind of between 4 and 5 and 7 o'clock, basically at the kind of bottom of the city. And then the louder camps, like the dance camps or sound camps, are at the edges at 11 o'clock and at 2 o'clock.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's how those camps get placed. And then after that, it's first come, first serve. So you can camp where there's a space open.
Oh, I didn't realize. So yeah, and there's always, I hear about like the big long queue as people are kind of waiting to get in. So they're driving, you know, from all these different urban areas generally to go to this place in the middle of the desert, and they have to leave early so that they can, you know, find their space.
Yes, it's kind of a people call it a land grab. That's why, right. Yeah, it's a privilege to get your placement, so you don't have to stress out about that.
Gotcha. You know, I'm really interested in, through the field work that you've done, what kinds of maybe new understandings or what kinds of areas you've been able to maybe debunk some misconceptions about Burning Man. I guess I would start with saying that I think probably one of the biggest misconceptions, we talked about it a little bit at the beginning, is this idea that it's a sort of anarchistic society. But even beyond that, that people just go there to do drugs. Like, I think that's a common thing that people think when they think about Burning Man, is like, oh, it's like this crazy party in the desert where everybody's just really trashed.
Yes, I think that's definitely what most people think about as what mm-hmm. happens at Burning Man. And the reality of being there is very different. I mean, one of the things about it to remember is just its sheer size. It is 70 to 75,000 people who are gathered there. And so Burning Man is not one place. It is the size of a city, of a small city. And so you can see kind of whatever you want to see there. Yeah, sure. There are some mm-hmm. people that are interested in dancing all night and taking drugs in various ways, but that is not the overwhelming feeling at all of being at Burning Man. There are so many camps that give different kinds of activities away. So from pancake breakfasts, to yoga classes, to contact improv and dance camps, to religious ceremonies of every possible stripe. And there are also many camps that are kind of interested in experimental ideas on the playa, whether it's developing 3D printers or different kinds of alternative energy experiments. And there's also a real sort of spiritual side of Burning Man that is interesting in terms of what people kind of get out of that experience. One of the things, places that I think is really interesting is the temple. And mm-hmm. the temple is placed at 12 o'clock in the clock shaped city. And that's a place where people go and for kind of quiet, peaceful times. People bring offerings and leave them at the temple. People write things on the temple walls. And then at the very end of Burning Man, that structure is burned also. So it is in striking contrast to the idea of Burning Man being this big, no rules party. And those kinds of things, those kind of quiet, hanging out in the neighborhood ethos is, I think, more prevalent than the kind of party scene, though both are present for sure.
Right. And it does seem like even amongst the people that I've spoken to who spend time in Burning Man because of maybe the excitement of the, like you mentioned, the party scene, in addition to the people who are going for a more like contemplative sort of get away from the rat race, like refind myself, reason, there does seem to be, you're right, this spirituality that runs through it. Like even in those who go to and they take drugs and they have fun, it does seem like psychedelic drugs seem to be the more popular drugs mm-hmm. at a place like Burning Man yeah. for that reason, right? That there's an elevation or some sort of like spiritual component to it that's really important to people.
Yeah. And I think the place of Burning Man contributes to that too. It's kind of getting out of your comfort zone in various ways, or living, like you've been saying, this kind of alternative life for a week. And that extends to, you know, that people wear costumes or kind of wacky clothing. And the landscape itself is so otherworldly. I mean, it's in this very massive, flat, former lake bed. And so you're kind of nowhere at the same time that you're in this city that is full of, you know, bright lights and fire and flashing signs and strange buildings and art that you can climb on. So all of those components are kind of dovetailed together in the experience of being there.
And you talk about, you know, the place itself, the site being this interesting sort of flat riverbed. It's quite barren. It's in the middle of the desert. You know, I often think of it as being maybe a little bit of an oppressive area in terms of like the heat, in terms of the dust. I'm wondering, I'm not really sure even how to ask this question because there's so many components to it, but oftentimes we think about historical archaeology and anthropology, and we think about the far reaches of the planet where our own ancestors decided to venture out, right? We know that we all originate in sort of the belt of life in Africa and ultimately chose, had an interest, or maybe were forced to venture out to these new places. And I often wonder, and I think it's not an uncommon thing to wonder, like, why did people go there? You know, that place seems hard to live. Like, why would you end up in, you know, Siberia? Or why would you end up at the equator or in the middle of the desert? And I think of Burning Man as this area that's like not conducive to life. I'm wondering how that plays into some of the research that you've been doing.
Oh, that's such an interesting question because there are so many answers to this. I will start by saying how the reason how it got there to begin with is kind of connected to this idea of it being as far away from everything. And it initially, when Burning Man started, it was the first years that a man was raised, a wooden man was raised and burned, happened in San Francisco. And that event started out with Larry Harvey and his friend Jerry James, and they just got together, went to Baker Beach, dragged this big wooden man, also a wooden dog. I mean, it could be called Burning Dog. and they burned a man, and a bunch of people kind of came together, and it was this spectacle and community and all of those things together. So they started to do it again. And then a organization, and I use that term very loosely, called the Cacophony Society, got involved with the Baker Beach Burning Man. And they started to publicize it. And then when Burning Man got shut down by the police in 1990, and the Cacophony Society was interested in doing these alternate zone trips, and they had heard about the Black Rock Desert. So they invited the Larry Harvey and Jerry James to kind of move Burning Man. It wasn't really anything organized at that point, from San Francisco to this really otherworldly place where you could get away with anything. You could shoot stuff. You could blow things up. So this getting away from it all was absolutely critical to its formation. But one of the things that also strikes me about this place is, you know, I got involved with archaeology out in the Black Rock Desert through the more traditional kinds of archaeology. I've been studying Depression era mining camps that are in existence just to the east of the playa, and studying an important site that was part of the Oregon and California trails that's just west of the playa. And those were also terrible places for people. And especially the site that's it's just a stone's throw from where Black Rock City is built every year.
their diary entries from people who had to cross the playa. And they talk about the miles in that area being the longest ones they've ever seen. And right. that it's an awful, gloomy place. And all of these terrible stories about crossing this barren land with no water, no grass, no nothing. So it's been a place of remote challenge for many years.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing. I mean, you know, it's completely understandable. Let's get out of our normal cities and our dwellings and our air conditioning and our high heels, and let's go to a place that's undeveloped and a place that's as far away from home that's still, I guess, convenient to home. But there is something very strange about the idea of like, let's go someplace where it's just uncomfortable and then try and make it comfortable within the confines and constraints of only being there for a week and then needing to be able to tear down everything we build up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think people also really embrace that challenge of what you can get away with there. I don't think, you know, these massive bonfires would not be possible in a place that has trees nearby. No trees for miles and miles and miles.
Don't do that in Southern California. The forest. The forestry is going to come after you. Yeah.
But also that kind of the starkness of the environment means that color and massive building takes on a very different life out there than it does when you have a backdrop that has a little bit more visual interest. You know, I think that, and we've certainly seen this in recent years with, you know, Instagram and Facebook and other social media, where it's just a very photogenic scene to have someone walking around in their, fake fur top and their massive moonwalker boots and their headdress or whatever it is that they've costumed themselves with, that the backdrop is so neutral and nothing that it makes all of these things kind of stand out. And that definitely contributes to the way that it can be satisfying to be in such an unfamiliar place.
Yeah, you're right. It's almost like a strange post-apocalyptic cyberpunk kind of Mad Max aesthetic to it that I think is really attractive to a lot of people.
Yeah, and some camps really build on that. There is a Thunderdome at Burning Man that happens every year where you can battle your friend in a showdown, you know, out of Mad Max, the movie. So there's people are really interested in those things. I think also as far as, what people build, it's a very flat, spacious area. So you can take up space and build things at a scale that you just can't in other places.
Right. Yeah. And the elements are different there. So you're working within a different kind of creative constraint, which is, I think, a fun challenge for a lot of people, especially those that have more of that kind of engineering interest. It's definitely one of these things where, you know, as an archaeologist, Burning Man and Black Rock City as a whole, I could only assume must inform you in a very special way about what it is to be a modern human, right? We can study active societies. We can study Eastern societies, Western societies across the globe and try to understand more about the way that we live and the way that we interact and relationships and individuality and all of the things that anthropologists really focus on. But this is kind of a strange, almost like pseudo-artificial, temporary microcosm of at least a United States sort of Western aesthetic or Western society. You know, how does that translate for you? What are some of these very important, I think, human takeaways that that you've been able to publish about over the years?
there are so many things at Burning Man that relate to this question. One of the things that I think has been most interesting is just thinking about domestic space and how people choose to build their homes. Most people today, they move into a house and make it their own in whatever ways. And that's interesting to me too. But in Black Rock City, every home that is constructed there is developed from scratch at the beginning of Burning Man. And there you really see what people's priorities are. One of the things that I'm interested in is the way that people kind of create public space and create private space in their homes. And at Burning Man, that's really visible in some interesting ways. So I think one of the things that's so fascinating is the way that that spaces can be used for multiple things. We often think about space as having, you know, a very finite set of functions, and now that everyone works from home, we know that that is not true. That dining room table has many functions, and dining may be the least important one of all. But at Burning Man, public and private is executed in fascinating ways. You know, we have this idea of Burning Man as being so open and free, and you know, you can do whatever you want. But I have found that those distinctions between what is public and what is private are in fact quite rigid at Burning Man. So people have their private space that no one is invited into, but they also have a public space that is very public. So those spaces really live at opposite ends of a continuum, and it takes a different form in different kinds of camps. But that's one of the things that I've really focused on in looking at how people live, is where that private space starts, where the public space is, and how public is their private space, how private is their public space. And that's different from one camp to another. There are also interesting ways, I think, that people interact with their environment. That this is another interesting example of the way people live within the rules that they are given. You know, as we've talked about, people have to bring out all of their own trash. Nothing is allowed to be left on the playa. You're not even allowed to pour gray water onto the playa. So people have all kinds of creative ways of addressing those issues. So whether it's laying out all of the food waste to dry and get desiccated and not smelly at all, so that when they pack it back in their car, it's not terribly unpleasant. Different mechanisms to evaporate water, and those kinds of things, and the centrality or not within the camp is also something that is variable and consistent. And this is what anthropologists do, right? Is we like to see the ways that people act individually, but we also see the ways that they are acting collectively. And then another thing I think that working at Burning Man has revealed in terms of the way that people live their daily lives is the centrality of human waste and its impact on how people live and how they settle. One of the structuring components at Burning Man is the porta potty. And in fact, for a while, there was a rumor going around that Burning Man couldn't get any bigger because it already used all the porta potties that were available on the West Coast. But that's not true. But it kind of indicates how important that is. And the banks of porta potties are one of the key things that are laid out when the city is mapped onto the playa at the very beginning. And people camp in relationship to those porta potties. You know, you want to be upwind, you want to be not too far, not too close, and those kinds of ways that human waste really dictates how we live.
Oh, yeah, that's so interesting. Between like solid waste, liquid waste, our trash, exactly how we deal with these things. I mean, it really reminds me of being a child in some of these courses that I was lucky enough to be involved in, like a really good gifted and talented program as a child. And we would compete in all these different things like Odyssey of the Mind and Future Problem Solvers. And there were these big organized events where we would be faced with trying to solve big world problems. And I think a common theme that we would see is, you know, if we were to create some sort of colony or civilization, you know, move some sort of civilization into space, how do you deal with these kinds of issues? Like, making waste, what do you do with it? I mean, these are obviously some of the issues that most plague us on planet Earth, pollution, water usage, you know, what to do with things that don't biodegrade and things that we can't really readily recycle. And of course, again, Burning Man is a microcosm of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Burning Man gets a bit of a pass too, because it is only 1 week. So the solution often is the same solutions that we have ultimately, which is, well, you carry your trash out and go throw it in a dumpster somewhere outside of the city. But it does expose, I think, the centrality of some of those issues that feel on a daily basis to us like they're more marginal, that we know that landfills are a problem, but in a world of privilege, one isn't face to face with them very often. And Burning Man exposes how those issues, I mean, if you had to live at Burning Man for a longer period of time, it would get much, much messier. And it's sort of the stressors are relieved very quickly at Burning Man, but you can see the ways that they also would build if you were needed to stay there much longer.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like this idea that when we're living in our homes, we often just throw things away as if there was an away. It's like we put it in a magic box and then it gets, you know, hauled away by magic people who come in the middle of the night. Whereas in Burning Man, you are, you know, that box is not magic. You are that person, at least temporarily, but probably something that I would be, you know, personally really interested is the encampments where that is their main focus. Like their focus is, like you mentioned, using green energy or renewables, or their focus is being a completely trashless society. So like we will not use anything that cannot be reused into something else. Like that's a really cool challenge that I think is at the top of a lot of people who go to Burning Man's minds.
Yeah, I think that is true for a lot of people. And I think the reverse is also true, that it is also a place of tremendous waste where it is an example of, one of the things that I think about Burning Man is it's this, you know, burning of excess in our culture. I mean, things are literally burned that don't need to be burned. It's sort of for fun and for symbolic value. And in fact, one of the things that you can do at Burning Man is rather, if you have things that are burnable, you can burn them rather than recycle them or reuse them. So I think that, you know, the opposite of this truth is also a truth, that it is a place where you sort of see that creativity in dealing with human waste and its impact on settlements. And you see the ways that we are interested in ignoring those problems and kind of relishing waste and superfluity in our worlds.
Absolutely. As if just lighting something on fire really does make it vanish. But ultimately, as we know, you know, it's a massive source of pollution. And that's another kind of archaeological, I guess, artifact, you could say, is that you can see the results of this burning, can't you?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing also, because one of the issues at Burning Man from the beginning is how do you protect the playa from these events that are so hot? And originally it was basically creating like fired clay underneath the burns. But now they have a pretty sophisticated system of digging out underneath where all of the big burns will happen. And they put in this degraded gravel underneath that serves as a buffer between the very, very hot fire and the playa itself. So archaeologically, we would see evidence of that because it would be different kinds of soils if this place were to be excavated, you know, in however many years. But it is far less damaging to the playa itself than it used to be by digging these holes and putting the degraded gravel in there. And that also allows, like, there are networks of cables and wires that are part of these massive burns so that the fireworks and the different pyrotechnics can happen before the man is burned.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. It's like an iterative kind of improvement. But then, of course, that causes us to ask that question of like, what is progress and what is improvement? You know,
right.
If we become better at one thing in an effort to solve a problem, does that not create a completely new problem that now we have to solve? It's such an interesting idea. I mean, it's such a really cool way for you to be doing your academic work and for us to be able to learn more about ourselves, really, through the work that you do. And I'm just really grateful that you were able to take the time today to share with us some of your findings and some of the insights that you've gathered. And of course, your book obviously houses many more, The Archaeology of Burning Man, The Rise and Fall of Black Rock City. Is there anything, Carolyn, that we didn't really touch on that you think, we would be remiss if we didn't mention?
Well, I think one thing about Burning Man that I'll just add here at the end of a very enjoyable conversation is one thing that I have come away from this project with it is understanding that Burning Man, it gives me an opportunity to see a city and its cyclicality, you know, how it's set up, how people live in it, how they take it down. And it's an amazing place because it's temporary and that it is this massive city that exists for only 1 week each year. But it has also really exposed to me the ways that Burning Man and Black Rock City are also just the same as everywhere else, that we're all living in these temporary structures that are just a little bit less temporary than Burning Man in one way or another.
Yeah, if you really like zoom out and look at it from a different time scale, you're so right.
Yeah. So Burning Man allows me to see these spaces and really has informed the ways that I see the world and other active sites that I've moved on to study as well. It's kind of all the same thing. It's just happens at a different speed and that, you know, some places are more temporary than others.
Yeah. And that's ultimately, I think, one of those great things that you hear sometimes from sort of astronauts who are up in the ISS and they talk about the cosmic perspective. And, you know, the more that you really talk to anthropologists, sociologists, psychologists across the board is, you know, there's so much variability amongst us, but also the commonalities are really breathtaking. And it really reminds me of a quote from this movie that I used to love as a kid called SLC Punk, where the guys are bemoaning the fact that they've never left Salt Lake City and they just want to travel. And they have this kind of rich older friend who's been places before. And he's finally like, what do you think is out there? It's just people and cars and houses. Like, it's a little different, but it's all pretty much the same. And it's, you know, in many ways, that's a really profound statement, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and it could be applied to Burning Man as well. Yeah.
So, Carolyn, you know, I always close my episode by asking my guests the same two questions. And as an archaeologist and as somebody who has such interesting research of foci, I'm definitely fascinated to hear your responses to these kind of big picture questions.
Okay.
All right. So I want you to think about the future. I know you spend a lot of time thinking about the past, but also in relation to the future and the present. So this time I want you to think about the future, and you can think about it in whatever context is relevant to you right now. You know, this could be the future of yourself, your family, your work, or maybe something a little more global, you know, American society, the world as a whole. And I want you to think about, number one, what is the thing that really does keep you up the most at night? The thing you're most concerned about, maybe frustrated by, I don't know, pessimistic about, potentially even cynical about. But then on the flip side of that, so we can kind of end on a positive note, I'd love to know, what is it that you're genuinely, authentically optimistic about? What are you looking forward to?
Well, those are very good questions. And there are, well, gosh, so many in each category. Right. I don't know which category has more.
I know. I'm like, pick one.
I think
that's easy.
I guess I will say that I, at this moment, I mean, but this is a very particular moment in time. Mm-hmm. Not that other moments aren't, but I think that the, I'm going to pick the same thing that makes my blood run cold and gives me some optimism. And I would say that the attention to the Black Lives Matter movement at this point mm-hmm. in time has me extremely upset and also optimistic. As a white person of great privilege, I think that people that I deal with on a regular basis have finally woken up to some things that we've seen, you know, for many, many years now. And that is the pervasiveness of that is very disturbing. The lack of movement within that movement up till now is very disturbing. But at the same time, I am encouraged that perhaps it will finally make people make some changes. And so I guess I am equal parts optimistic and pessimistic about that right now. So I am hopeful and very cynical at the same time. So I'm not going to leave you on a totally positive note, because I think that positivity about that makes for complacency.
Absolutely.
But I have seen people who I never thought would say the words, you know, systemic racism, saying those words, and that gives me some hope.
Yeah, I mean, it's been like there's like that cautious optimism when you actually do see policy change as a direct result of collective community action. And when you actually do start to see sort of an awareness that individual privilege prevented for so long. But the fear is that the systems are so strong and the actual kind of concerted effort to repress or maintain those systems has a lot of power, right? Governmental power right now. And so the fear is that without the momentum, this just falls back into that complacent place. And so I don't know, there is a hope that I have as well, seeing that the movement hasn't died, seeing that even in superficial things like my social media feeds, the hashtag is trending every single day, and I'm seeing people posting continuously, and that does bring me a bit of hope. And you know, I think sometimes the idea that this is it requires generational change, sadly, that it just doesn't happen fast enough. But I'm very hopeful about even my generation of people in their 30s. But then when I look at people in their 20s and people in their teens, I'm so incredibly hopeful by how much more aware of LGBTQIA issues, of, you know, trans lives, of ethnic minorities, and the horrific kind of yeah, systemic racism that they faced and just brutality that they faced. The fact that these kids, they know it in their bones.
Yeah.
And they see the injustice, I think, is that to me is what's super, super hopeful. So I'm right there with you.
Yep. Agreed. Yes.
Well, Carolyn, this was a really fascinating chat on a topic that I think very confidently say I never thought I would be talking about, especially not to somebody who is an academic. So I am really grateful that you brought this to my attention and to the attention of everybody listening today.
Well, it's been really fun to talk to you about it.
Absolutely. And everybody listening, hey, guys, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.